Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, a break from politics. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood aired its final episode in 2001. Fred Rogers passed away 2 years later. But the legacy of Mr. Rogers is stronger than ever. Last year's film about Rogers, titled Won't You Be My Neighbor, became the highest-grossing biographical documentary of all time. It airs on PBS and HBO this weekend. And now, a recently published book tells his story from childhood to his status as an American icon. It's called The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. I spoke with the book's author, Maxwell King, about why children and adults continue to turn to Mr. Rogers for comfort and guidance. Maxwell King, what a pleasure to talk with you.
So good to be with you.
You know, even after his death in 2003, in February, Mr. Rogers just continues to hold in our minds. There's the documentary, there's your book. I have replayed my conversation with him so many times. Why do you think that is? Why do you think he still looms so large in our minds?
Well, I think Fred is often thought of as a pivotal and important educational figure in the 20th century, and certainly he was. In early childhood education, he was a crucial innovator. But what I think is so attractive about Fred and so enduring about Fred is his position as a cultural icon who represents the very best values, the best human values, the best Christian values, the best values of every sort one can imagine. And that's why I think people continue to gravitate toward him when there's stresses in society, when there are struggles in society. People come back to him for that reason.
He really developed a powerful connection between America's parents, America's children. I mean, he taught us all.
And through multiple generations. There were several generations of children who grew up listening to the neighborhood, and then their children grew up listening to the neighborhood. And I think principally through what he taught children, but also how he responded to the challenges that adults encountered, he just wove himself into the fabric of our society as an exemplar of living by the very best values.
You know, I talked with him in December of 2002.
This is Queen Sarah speaking.
Of course it is. How nice to meet you. He was on the line from Pittsburgh, which is where you are this morning. I'd like you to hear a little clip.
I always wanted to meet you, Diane. This is X the Owl.
Well, I'm so pleased to meet you.
Well, thanks. And my neighbor is Henrietta Pussycat. Just a second, I'll get her.
Meow.
Hey, Hen, come on out here.
Meow, 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 meow.
Yeah, it's Diane Rehm.
Meow, meow, Diane Rehm.
Oh.
Meow. Meow, love Meow program.
Oh, Meow, you're just marvelous. I'm so pleased to meet you.
Meow, too. Meow, 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 visit Meow, 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 meow.
Oh, that for sure.
Oh, how wonderful. You know, Max, in my interview with him, I joked that we are probably the two slowest talkers in broadcasting.
Isn't that the truth?
But, I mean, the truth is that that was really intentional on his part and absolutely critical to his success. How come?
I think there's two reasons, really. I think one reason is a programming reason. He was addressing very young children, and he wanted to go at a pace that he thought was appropriate for them. And he was very conscious of the fact that in the production of radio and television and other kinds of audio, most of the programming went very, very rapidly. And as the years went on, more and more rapidly. So he was very conscious of going at a pace that was appropriate for the children who were in his audience. But there's a second reason for it, and that is Fred's philosophy of life. I'm sometimes asked when I do book events to try to sum up in a succinct phrase what Fred's philosophy of life was. And, of course, I can't do that, but I'm willing to put a label on it because we do live in a soundbite age. And I think if you simplify Fred's message down to the bare bones, it's this: slow down, be kind. He was very focused on kindness, respect, consideration, those kinds of values. But he was very conscious of the fact that to live those values, you had to slow down. You couldn't go speeding around. And so it was a part of his métier, both as a performer and as a person, as a human being.
I think many people find it surprising that Fred Rogers came from an extraordinarily wealthy background. He had a chauffeur who drove him to school each morning, about which I think he was more than a little embarrassed.
Yes, yes. His family lived in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, which is a small city east of Pittsburgh, an industrial city. The family owned a number of industries there, and they were quite wealthy, and Fred grew up wealthy and privileged. He had a wonderful mother who was so caring and devoted to him and paid such good, careful attention to him, but she was overprotective. There's no question that she contributed to his shyness, to his being introverted as a little boy because of being overprotective. And she did. The family had a chauffeur, and they took him to elementary school. He tried to get the chauffeur to let him off a block away so he wouldn't be embarrassed in front of his fellow students. But, you know, Fred handled his wealth really, really well, I think. First of all, he never focused on wealth and money. He never pursued it. He didn't really care about it. But secondly, he used the wealth that his family brought him for independence so that he could pursue his vision of educational television. Hmm. And multiple times during his life, he was able to take a direction or take a pause in his career, develop new programming because he could lean on that wealth. He could rely on it. And so I think I admire the fact that Fred was not distracted by wealth, but also that he was kind of strategic and smart in how he used it to give himself freedom to pursue the educational vision that he had.
You know, it's very interesting. You talk about the protectiveness that his mother brought to his life. He did struggle with asthma. He spent lots of time indoors, and it was there, I recall, that he played with puppets, he created games, he created plays. He was a very imaginative child because he spent so much time alone.
He did. He had a lot of struggles as a child, and I think those struggles informed for him what he wanted to accomplish in helping other children later in his life. But he was a very, very creative, very bright little boy, and he used the time that he had as a little boy, devoting himself to developing a puppet theater, which one of his playmates reported many, many, many years later. When she came to his house to view that puppet theater, she felt she saw sort of the seminal moment of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in that early puppet theater. But he also developed his devotion to music. When he was a very, very little boy, he had a toy piano. He had an instinct for harmony and for music. He could hear a tune played one time, and he could play it on his little piano. And he relied on music. He took solace in music, but it also became a part of his artistry as he was growing up.
His father really, really hoped that Fred would join him in the family business. That had to have been a disappointment to Fred Rogers' father.
Yes, but his father was great, too. His father was sometimes nonplussed by Fred, sometimes puzzled by Fred, particularly the fact that Fred had a new career plan every 6 months. He wanted to be a diplomat. He wanted to teach French. He was quite proficient in French. He decided he might be a college professor. Then he decided that he wanted to work with children. Then he decided he was going to become a composer and a musician, and he majored in music at Rollins College. And all the while, his father was hoping that he would recover from these serial delusions of different careers and become a businessman, because they had a bunch of businesses in La Trobe, and the father was hoping Fred would be the one to run them one day. But the father was also, like the mother, so patient with Fred and treated him always as a very serious person. I think, you know, Fred taught us how important that is with children, to view them and to treat them as very serious people. And he did get that from his parents. And when Fred finally declared in the spring of his senior year in school, he was heading to New York to go into television, a brand new thought in his senior year in college, his father was once again disappointed, but once again supported Fred. And he knew people at RCA and NBC in New York. And he reached out and he made a connection. Fred got an internship there, and it really was a pivotal moment in getting Fred started and getting him the base of experience that he needed to succeed in television.
The other aspect of his life was his decision to go into the Presbyterian ministry. He did earn a Doctor of Divinity, and the Presbyterian leadership wanted him to take a church, to begin as an associate pastor, then to move in to take a church to preach each week. And they would have no part of his desire to really encompass the issue of children in his ministry.
One of Fred's ambitions always, from the time he was a little boy, was to become a Presbyterian minister. I don't think he ever intended to become a typical minister with a typical congregation and a practice. But he was a devoted Presbyterian, and he always did want to go to the seminary. And when he was at WQED here in Pittsburgh, and he was producing the Children's Corner, which was a precursor to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, he decided to go to the seminary. He was doing all these things. He was actually the program manager for the station. He was producing and writing and creating and doing music and doing puppets for the Children's Corner. And every day he would drive over to the seminary and take courses there. And during that time, he told some of his teachers who asked him what his intentions were. He said, "I want to have a ministry to children on television." And the teachers said a couple of things. First of all, they said, "Well, that's a crazy idea. Good luck with that. That's not going to happen." And it didn't. The Presbytery never did support that idea. But one of the teachers also sent him over to the University of Pittsburgh to study early childhood development with Dr. Margaret McFarland, extraordinary academic. And one of the little-known stories in Pittsburgh, most people here still don't know it and don't appreciate it, but I try to give a full account to it in the book, is that in the 1950s, the University of Pittsburgh was the center in the United States of fresh academic thinking about early childhood. And it wasn't just Dr. Margaret McFarland. Dr. Benjamin Spock was there. Dr. Barry Brazelton was there. Eric Erickson, the great philosopher and thinker about human development, was there. There was this center of extraordinary, vibrant thinking about early childhood. And Fred Rogers, again, a great stroke of good fortune in his life, got dropped into the middle of that and got what he wanted more than anything in the world, which was the material to make really intelligent educational programming to a high academic standard.
You know, what's interesting about that, Max, is that he and Dr. Spock had such different ways of approaching children.
Right, and that was what was changing in the 1950s, principally at the University of Pittsburgh, but around the world, in Russia and Germany and other places. And it was the old Victorian notion of childhood, which is better seen, not heard.
Absolutely.
You know, the Victorian notion was that childhood is a sort of a disease. And if you leave them alone, they'll get over it and they'll turn into good little grown-ups. You know, just they'll get through it. They'll recover from the disease of childhood and become grown-ups. Well, what they were learning is the opposite is true. Those first few years of life are the critical, essential learning period in all of life, not just in terms of intellectual development, but social and emotional development, which is what Fred was so focused on, and in terms of language, in terms of brain development. So the paradigm was being flipped. And of course, Spock played a big role in it, even though he came out of that older Victorian tradition, because Spock helped organize the Center for Child Development at Pitt, he played a pivotal role in that changing thinking. And, you know, Fred got the benefit of that to make really, really powerful educational television. But those academics got the benefit of Fred, because Fred then taught America about the importance of early childhood education.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Max King.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Maxwell King. His new book is titled The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. So he, Fred Rogers, and Dr. McFarland really developed the most groundbreaking children's television.
Right. Fred did about 7 years of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and then he took a hiatus.
Right.
And he did some adult television with NPR and PBS and others, some of which is interesting. I don't think it's any of it's as good as his children's television. But it was gnawing at him that he hadn't accomplished all that he thought he could accomplish, all that he wanted to accomplish. And he came up with this idea with the help of Dr. McFarland that he would come back to children's television. This is in 1980. And he would come back and he would start doing things that he and McFarland called theme weeks. So they would take a theme and they would develop it for the whole week. So 5 days of programming, the neighborhood of make-believe, the real neighborhood, the home neighborhood in his house, all of that programming over 5 days, one theme, all of which was incredibly ambitious programming for children's television. But here's the kicker. The themes that he took on, he was so courageous. He took on the most challenging themes, not just of childhood, but of life. He took on violence. He took on the loss, you know, a child's fear of getting lost is one of the greatest fears a child can have. He took on divorce. He took on all these extremely difficult issues. He took on superheroes because he was concerned about children being misled by television programming, and he wanted to deconstruct it and teach them about it. So in the 1980s, with the help of Dr. McFarland, she didn't die until the late 1980s, he made these theme weeks that are Diane, they're still the most extraordinary programming you can see. Even, you know, I watched so much of it because I had to write
sure.
the book. I was going to say I'm a grown-up. Heck, I'm an old man. And I'm sitting there riveted by these explorations of all of these themes.
I listened to one which I'd like to play now. This clip on divorce brought me to tears. Let's hear it.
What are you feeling bad about, Prince Tuesday?
My mother and dad.
What's wrong with them?
They fight all the time.
I never saw them fight.
But you don't live with them.
Well, my mother and dad fight sometimes, too.
I never saw them fight.
Well, you don't live with them.
Anyway, Dad wants to get another airplane, and Mom thinks they use too much gas, and I guess it's all my fault.
What's your fault?
If they get a divorce.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, hi, Lady Aberlin.
Lady Aberlin, have you heard anything about the king and queen getting a divorce?
No, I haven't.
Well, Aunt Lady Elaine thinks that they will.
Sometimes Aunt Lady Elaine is wrong.
But sometimes she's right.
Why doesn't somebody ask the king and queen?
I'm not going to.
Why not?
I don't want to. They'll say it's my fault.
Tuesday, I've told you, buying airplanes and getting married and getting divorces and things like that are grown-ups' decisions, not children's.
Well, I'm going to play with Daniel and my toy planes and cars and...
And trucks.
That's right. And I'm not sure when I'm coming home, so there.
Well, there are a lot of people who love you and who hope that you will come back.
And that's enough to make you weep.
Yes, yes. It's so touching how he's able to use the characters in the puppet theater to explore the fears of the children and to try to open up those fears and try to expose what's going on for the children, what they're struggling with. And also, so often, Fred was trying to show the reluctance of children to talk about things, to their fears preventing them from opening up and talking about things. Fred had a wonderful phrase, which was, whatever is mentionable is manageable. Meaning talk about it, just talk to the grown-ups about it. And he used a number of themes, but particularly that one on divorce, to try to highlight that aspect.
You know, he was certainly not overtly political, but through the show, he embraced progressive views. I mean, I'm thinking about that famous scene where he shares a pool with Officer Clemens in 1969. Tell us about that.
Officer Clemens came onto the set of the show and he was tired and his feet were tired and Fred said he was the same. And so they put their feet together in a wading pool. Officer Clemens is African-American, so there were black feet and white feet together in the pool. And he reprised that scene about, oh, almost 30 years later, I guess. Yeah. Toward the end of the show, and at the end of the reprise, many, many years later, when they did the same thing, at the end of it, Fred then grabbed a towel and he dried Officer Clemens' feet with the towel, which, of course, is a visual reference to Jesus. Washing and drying
the feet.
And so Fred was expressing, again, not by talking about it, by showing it, Fred was expressing progressive views on race. And you're right what you said at the beginning, that Fred is so often viewed by most of his fans as someone who is, quote, not political. Well, he wasn't partisan political, and he very deliberately stayed out of partisan politics because he was teaching children and he didn't want to drag children into partisan politics. But let's be honest, Fred was political.
Indeed.
And he was very progressive.
How important do you believe he actually was to the development of public broadcasting?
Oh, I think he was essential.
We have a clip of Fred testifying before Congress.
Senator Pastore.
Under President Nixon, this is May 1st, 1969.
This is what I give. I give an expression of care every day to each child to help him realize that he is unique. I end the program by saying, you've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. And I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service for mental health.
You know, he became, as you know, early on sort of a spokesperson, not just for the idea of PBS and educational television, but he also became sort of a standard bearer for the idea of very high-end, high-quality television.
There are an awful lot of people who believe that had Fred relented on his adamant opposition to commercials in children's television, he could have made a lot of money.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. He was courted a number of times by network television to bring his show from educational television to commercial television. Also, his puppets had great value, and there were many purveyors, including the Disney Company, that tried to get access to licensing the puppets. And Fred always said, it's okay to advertise the show or do commercials or advertise the puppets or sell the puppets to grown-ups, but you must not ever make a commercial aimed at a very young child because they don't know the difference between information on a show and a commercial. And he was adamant about that. But again, Fred didn't really care about money. You know, Sesame Street and Jim Henson were able to make scores of millions of dollars by commercializing, and I'm not criticizing them for doing that. But Fred, too, could have become, I think, quite wealthy beyond the family wealth that he got. But he felt that it was a moral imperative not to trick children.
Tell us about the more personal side of Fred Rogers. How was he, for example, as a parent?
I think Fred was a wonderful, fabulous parent, and he also was a struggling parent who had a lot of difficulty, particularly with his teenage boys. When his boys were very young, he took care to be home every day. If they were going to be continuing filming into the evening, he would come home. Jim, his older son, said sometimes he showed up in pancake makeup and had dinner with them and then would go back to television. He spent a lot of time talking to his children, and he was always careful to be present. Even when he had to travel for the show, he wouldn't travel for very long because he wanted to be home with those little boys. And they both, in the interviews I did with them, deeply appreciated what a present parent he was, not just present in terms of being there, but also being responsive to them. When they grew up to be teenagers, Fred lost the thread. He really struggled dealing with them as teenagers.
What do you mean?
Well, one of my favorite stories that Joanne Rogers, Fred's widow, told me, they had a big house in the east end of Pittsburgh, and there were a lot of rooms down in the basement, and she was going down to the laundry room, and she saw this little crack of light on the ceiling down in the distance in the basement. She followed it and found a door and opened a door, and it was a grow light for marijuana. The boys were raising some marijuana in the basement. And Fred was furious. He was so angry at them and made them bring the plants up and destroy them. But he confided in Joanne after that about how much more difficult it was for him to connect with teenagers than very little children. And given that all his professional life was focused on very little children, I guess that's not surprising.
Now, I must tell you that when Fred Rogers was on my program in December of 2002, I said to him, "Mr. Rogers, do you ever get sad?" And he said, "Oh, of course I do." And I said, "Well, what do you do when you're sad?" And he said, "Well, I play the piano a lot, and I think I'll be playing the piano a lot today." And I said, "Why are you sad?" And he said, "Because my stomach hurts."
Ah.
Now, Max, that was December of 2002, and he died in February of 2003. He died, I gather, of stomach cancer.
Right.
Do you think he knew when he spoke to me that he had stomach cancer?
I do. Yes, I do. He had been having the stomach pains for almost a year. He put off going to the doctor because he was still very busy, even though he had retired from making Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He was still very busy. He was traveling. He had obligations. He put it off. I don't know if it would have made a difference if he'd gone in sooner. You don't know what the course of a stomach cancer might be. But he knew then when he talked to you that in January he was to have surgery for stomach cancer. And at that point, his doctors felt there was a much better than 50-50 chance that they'd be able to get the stomach cancer and reduce the size of his stomach and that he'd be able to go on. But when they did the operation in January, it was too late.
I did not have the courage to ask him why his stomach hurt. Yeah. But when I heard that he had died, I was so sad, feeling as though perhaps he wanted to say something about that.
But I think he did, didn't he? He did say, because he said, "My stomach hurts and I'm sad today and I'll be playing the piano." So he said what he wanted to say.
Well, let's end with hearing Fred Rogers sing. He did this at the end of our conversation in 2002.
Would you like A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, or would you like the song that we usually sing at the end, which is, "It's such a good feeling to know you're alive."
Yes.
"It's such a happy feeling. You're growing inside, and when you wake up ready to say, 'I think I'll make a snappy new day.' It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends." And I feel that we are, Diane. Thank
you. Oh, Fred Rogers, I have so looked forward to this hour and so enjoyed talking with you. I'm appreciative for your new book, the Mr. Rogers Parenting Book. I think it's going to help an awful lot of people, just as your program for all these years has been with and supported so many children. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And Maxwell King, on that note, I want to thank you for writing this really comprehensive book about a man I call my dear friend and indeed my hero, Fred Rogers. Thank you, Max.
Oh, I thank you. What a lovely opportunity to be with you, Diane. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereem.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urib-Lipker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next week. I'm Diane Rehm.